Ravana. And Ravana, because you know the personality is one of the Maha demons, or Rakshasas. But we also understand Ravana to literally mean one who makes others cry, one who brings sadness, one who puts others in such a situation, which of course is the lifestyle and the activities of the demons. There's so many ways we can reflect on this wonderful pastime in terms of the adventure, the romance. It says here, adventure, love, wisdom. We look at integrity and dharma and character. We look at the tremendous commitment that's there. We also look at the constant difficulties that are always a part of existing in the material world. We can say the mind also helps us to take a look at the depth of love that can be there amongst associates, can be there in the grihastha ashram. Also, we can see the complexity that even when pastime of the Lord, and there are issues, difficulties within the grihastha ashram. We can also see the tremendous disappointment that we experience as people traverse through so many different connections in the material world. Of those who are the closest to us, they can give us the greatest pain, they give us the greatest happiness. We look at destiny or providence. This is one point when Lakshman was being very disturbed about Lord Ram leaving. And Lord Ram was saying how that should not really take this in such a disturbing way, but should see that this is providence, what is taking place. This is that example when Prabhupada was having trouble with one Indian gentleman who was always in argumentative mood. And Prabhupada said that he must have done something to him in a previous life, which can help us to reflect on the fact that everything does have a specific or particular purposes. And so we begin to appreciate that more and more as we accept that Krishna is there. And then we're trying to see or watch it unfold, or we want to not interfere as it unfolds, and we want to do what we can to be able to honor it. Dr. Ross, so much wanting to have a son. And we see how, again, many things come together or happen at the same time, especially when we look at Krishna's Leela. So Dr. Rob arranging for the sacrifice, sending out the Atmaveda, sacrifice the horse, getting the benediction. At the same time, Ravana, having this tremendous benediction. It seems quite unusual that such sinful personality can somehow get such power from those who are pious or those who know Krishna. Just as in the case of Aranyakashipu, he gets amazing benedictions from Lord Brahma, or sometimes Lord Shiva. Also Indra, who are favorably associating with Krishna. And they arrange to give these boons to those who are diametrically, chemically opposed. But we also see how Krishna's glories are very much affirmed, not only by what he does through his direct loving exchanges, but also through his prowess and through how he annihilates these demons. And we see some of the love stories coming out in connection with the disturbance of the demons. Like in this story. Or how Indra and Lord Brahma are being positioned because the demons have become so rampant that when the sages would perform the yajnas, that they would crash the party. Or they would shower in auspicious things on the yajna. So here they were doing the yajna for honoring Dharma and for honoring Vedic culture. But here, the demons had such power that they were interfering. So sometimes it seems almost like the power of the demons can supersede that of the bhakti. But that never happens ultimately. Temporarily, there's always certain challenges that are there. And we see that Krishna himself even allows sometimes the demigods to be checked, because it's one of the ways that they are kept in place. They have such power, such control. They have so much sovereignty. But sometimes Krishna himself allows the demons to then harass and harangue the demigods just as a way of helping them, because then they have to refocus and turn back to the Paramahamsa, where the supreme power is residing. So here there was the intrigue of Ravana having to be killed, Dasarath being benedicted with sons. It was time for the Yuga Dharma, for the Lord to appear in particular way, and representing the perfect king, representing the perfect husband. And so many things happening simultaneously. But all to distinguish what is devotional, what is dharma, what is nātana dharma, and what is demonic activity, lack of virtue, lack of character, going against spiritual rule and law. And so it's an amazing story that can be examined and looked at in so many, many wonderful ways. But one dominant way is we see the victory over, triumphing constantly over evil, over all types of adversarial connections, personalities, and conditions. As we think of Ravana, who makes those cry, and we see how cocky sometimes that the demons get. I mean, Ravana was just so cocky, he didn't mind going any place and anywhere and dealing with anybody in any kind of foul manner, whether it meant taking someone's wife or raping someone or taking more of an empire or trying to annihilate someone, even to the point that we see that he was ready even to challenge Krishna. I want to look particularly at one little theme for a few minutes, and that's the theme of hearing from the right source. Because if we think about Kaikeyi, we see one of the biggest complexities is that she was nicely situated, but because of hearing from the wrong connection, then there was so much disturbance that has put one event after another. The heartbreak of Lakshman, the heartbreak of Dasara, the heartbreak of Sita, where their life and soul was simply to the service and associating with Lord Ram and wanting to see him being properly honored. But here, one personality having the power to make a difference. Just like we see how the danger in hearing from the Mayavadi, that even one seemingly on a rather advanced platform, by hearing such, there can be stagnation and even fall. Or by hearing a blasphemy. Why is it so dangerous to hear blasphemy? Because we are so habituated to the deviation, to the sin. And so we're just gradually kind of float above that. But it's so much a part of our conditioning. And just like the addict is so much absorbed in that addiction, that some little connection can then excite that whole consciousness where one begins to act in the proper way as if there was no change taking place. Or we see sometimes people hearing, you know, rhythmic type of philosophy, and then after some time they become so confused. prayer, sometimes some writings, and sometimes some activities of the smarta and the brahmanas. And some people have become so bewildered by such that they lean in that direction and become such. So I was sometimes just thinking how cultures develop and how they fall apart, how civilizations flourish and how they also fall, how propaganda sometimes is designed in warfare just to create certain level reflections that then causes certain types of problems, how governments are so active in information and misinformation, espionage, and they cause so many confusions in so many ways. And especially weak-minded people, or people who have a tendency for deviation, then they are most likely to be disturbed. People who are not so secure or have some doubts, those doubts can be stimulated, then they become so prone. Because the demonic class, or sometimes the sin, it comes in such a wonderful package. Or the deviation comes in such a wonderful package. Sometimes the deviation package is even more attractive than that which is genuine. Just like, historically speaking, many monasteries, sometimes temples, mandirs, are built in environments where it's not so easy to reach. Nunneries are like that sometimes also. Sometimes it needed to be placed in such places so that people would come there, they would have to literally have undergone austerity. So when they come, they're in a nice, humble mood and appreciation. But also, so it keeps out people who are not coming for the right reason. Some tracking has to go on the mountains, or go across waters, or it's outside of the normal orthodox ways for travel. And so, therefore, it takes a certain amount of intense dedication to want to reach that. And there's some shrines where it's built in such a way that coming in, you have to stoop or you have to bow so that you come in humbled in such a way. So sometimes a Krishna arranges for the Maya package to look like the genuine or to look even more attractive in such a way that people become bewildered. And that is there. Or just like the duping goes on in many different environments. But someone is susceptible to being duped, especially to the degree that they are looking for opportunity or devious themselves. The more one has a sort of a devious nature, the easier it is to convince them of something that is extraordinary, that is really extraordinary because it is fictitious. The more they're thinking, I'm going to cheat this person, the more they're thinking, I'm going to get big, big advantage, then the more they fall into the illusion and become duped. So Krishna is arranging his Maya's different potencies, and one of Maya's potencies is deterrent, one of Maya's potencies is to cover over. And so Maya working for Krishna then arranges such things as a way of also qualifying ourselves to take a closer look at what we have, what we are, what we want, etc. Sometimes it can become so confusing that people begin to think that the irreligious thing is religious. They begin to think, just like in the time of Bhaktivinoda, Sri Vaishnava Chakravarti and others around that time, that our Vaishnava culture was not only so degraded, what people thought about it, but actually some of the deviant sampradayas, their existence was based on deviation. Some of the bold sampradayas and others, groups who were sahajiyas, their actual existence was based on taking somebody else's wife or getting someone else's wife to leave and to deviate. Or it was based on taking ganja and engaging in promiscuous activities. That a core of his philosophy was based on such. So much of this kind of thing was going on that people not only did not want to embrace a gentleman, a gentlewoman, intelligent person that want to embrace Lord Chaitanya's movement, but they despised it. And such. Because this is what can happen when something is very powerful and then it gets distracted or the sin comes in. or something is very powerful, and then it's used improperly. Like we were talking today with the children. It's something that is so powerful is Vedic culture. That misuse of Vedic culture has created Mayavadism, has created casteism, has created the greatest abuse of women on the planet, these kinds of things. Something that is so powerful then can create such distinction. One of the reasons that so many of the Hindus became Muslims is because of misuse of Vedic culture, where they're being treated so bad by the Smarta Brahmanas, and then the Muslims were offering some basic healthy existence, at least materially, for them, and so they were eager to embrace something that gave them a sense of identity, a sense of well-being, etc. So sometimes people are thinking, senses that maybe these rules, is this something that's archaic? Or they're thinking that Krishna consciousness is just mythology? Or they're thinking that it is just a cult? So how do we kind of reflect on that? How do we consider mythology? Well, yes, it does come across mythological. It's like all of these wonderful stories. You analyze the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, it's all super extraordinary. It's all about the interaction of angelic beings, the Apsaras, Gandharas. It's all about extraterrestrials walking about, interacting with humankind. It's all about mystical weapons and mantras. Everything about these particular stories is super extraordinary. It's like some months ago I was giving a lecture in the business school in London, and they wanted me to speak on extraterrestrials. And I just started off by saying, what's the big deal? Everybody is an extraterrestrial. Now, what do we discuss? When you think about it, that is the case. Nobody is a resident here of this world. There may be some who come at different times, come a little later. Some who come and go a little more. But everybody is an extraterrestrial. So everything about these stories are super extraordinary because it has little to do with the normative patterns of the material world. And so here we see the kind of weapons that they're using, the transformations of their bodies to the very acidic powers, the mantras and things that the Lord and his agents are using as well as a demon. Super extraordinary. So, yes, people think here it's considered or think that it may be mythology. Yeah, it does seem to suggest that. Because it is far beyond what we normally see, do, think about, and experience. But this is one of the reasons we're excited, because we don't want just normal adventurous activity. We don't want just to be normal persons. We don't think God is just an ordinary Ishvara or controller. So we expect the super extraordinary. So people challenge us that this is mythology. We just look at them and think, it is unfortunate that in your particular consciousness, you're not able to be able to ascertain or to contain such things because you're trying to fit everything into the little socket that's already there and thinking something doesn't fit into that, that it's irrelevant. So we are happy that people think that this is so extraordinary. We're glad to be doing something very far out. We're glad to be different from those who are normal in a crazy environment. But people are living so much with the idea that they're going to get something. When everything they get, if they do get it, they're going to lose it. We're not disturbed that people are identifying basically with the bodily platform, and so they adjust everything based on being the body and based on that there's no supreme asamam bonam, so therefore they have trouble when they hear that there is love, there's an absolute God who gives absolute arrangements how to love him and specific ways how he reciprocates with such. Or people say, well, Krishna consciousness is a cult. Or even the sense of institution or community is a cult. We say, yes, it is a big cult. And we say that any group is a cult. The question is, what is the nature of the cult? Any powerful organization, any organized institution, any organized grouping is a cult, is a culture of something. You take a group of astronomers, a group of scientists, you take a group of generals, you take a group of superintendents of the schools, you take any type of group, they're the cults. They have a certain plan, and they have certain schemes, they have certain activities and they have a certain personality based on who they are. We are not intimidated that we do not, we don't want to be people who have no identity like a lot of crazy people are these days. Who have no identity, they don't know who they are, they have no plan, they have no structure, they have no organization, they have no short-term goals, long-term goals, they have no way of interacting based on those goals. We say, no way do we want to live like animals who just live only for reactive mode, for just conditioning and responding, and just trying to get something for maintaining their survival. Yes, we are, in essence, because what people normally call cult is something that is suppressive, something that is weird, something that takes people's lives. This is a big issue now internationally, and that recently, it's still happening now, maybe they're finding more, but they found now the biggest mass murder based on cult that's happened in the present-day history of this particular dispensation. Jonestown, I think about 900 people or something killed in mass murder, and now in Uganda, over more than that. And so this is a cult. And so now there's all in the news and all the different things going on now, and people beginning to look at everything that looks a little different, and they're pointing, cult. They're right, everything is a cult. The question is, what is the nature of the cult? What is its goal? What is its activity? Those who are saying cult in the news media or the anti-cult, they're a cult themselves. They're coming together with the idea of trying to present their cult idea versus another thing that they call a cult, and they have their plans, they have their books, they have their rules, they have the way how to analyze it, they categorize it, they live together, and they work together in different ways. They have their in-house stuff, they have their out-house stuff, and so they're bigger cults. Because they're really on a mission to try to tell the other cults that we are a better cult than you are, and your cult is dangerous. So therefore, we kidnap you because our cult has more power to influence you, and therefore we're going to impose on you. We're going to call ourselves right while we call you, by using your mind, we call it that you are being brainwashed. And so to show that you are in the bad shape and brainwashed, we're going to take your brain and your body and everything and capture it and then show you how to live to be free as we imprison you. But it's a craziness. We're not to be intimidated by the idea of having a mission consciousness, having focus, having determination, structure. Prabhupada came, and all the great acharyas, they came to give us a sense of form, a sense of commitment, a sense of mission, a sense of purpose. And some of them came with particular purposes, as we have Lord Ram, particular incarnation, or as we're looking in the school, Vamanadeva, and this incarnation, Matavatar, all these incarnations came for a particular reason to give a certain message to the world, to help the world in a certain way, based on certain things that were in fact taking place. So people will look at us closer and closer because with these mass murders going on, people are looking and they can begin to consider more and more something is different than it is of a negative nature. And if the different thing does have so much negativity, then it will support some of these their thesis. So if people see us as different, and we're definitely different in so many ways. We eat differently, our goals are different, our dress is different, our rituals are different, so many things. So that will be a great botheration if people then look at that and they see dysfunctionalism. If they look at that and they find that we're not communicating our message sufficiently. If they look at that and they find that there is too many questions, too much ambiguity. We have duty to help people as best as we can, to help them directly, indirectly. And therefore, we are careful to not cause them to make offense. We do not preach to the faithless. We are careful that we, at the same time, we are told that we are to be param dukkha, dukkha kripa and buddhi, merciful, kind to others. And we are to live to try to share the message. But it means that we are to share and to give, but when we find that giving hurts the person rather than help, then we are to back away. We are to try to give to everyone. And we only release or we refrain from giving if we find that in our giving, it is hurting the person rather than helping. If someone is too offensive or too obnoxious, then by whatever you're trying to give them, it just makes them harder and harder, more against Krishna. attack you and what you're representing, etc., then only we back away because we are not able to help them. And if we can help, we do not involve ourselves in hurting any particular person. So here, as we look at the tremendous sadness that they were going through when they were arranging for to leave because they're being banished, and realizing that one person, who was that? Who was the nurse? What's her name? Mantara, who basically was in good standing and had to be convinced over time that her own position was being challenged and her future was, did not have much of a future. And because she was so tactfully presented with such, then she became so much of a disturbance to God, so much of a disturbance to real morality, and using basic ethic, character, virtue, and dharma to suit her particular purpose. So one of the things we should immediately do when people present things to us, one of the most simplest things we do is we look and see what their philosophy has presented or what it does for them. 3 years ago, I was meeting with some of the mystic leaders in England. And I brought up a few very simple points. First point, isn't it interesting that every time Krishna comes himself, he takes a guru, active, living guru. And he, more than anybody, doesn't need a guru. So why we think we should do different than what Krishna himself has arranged? Then we explain, yes, perhaps your philosophy is very wonderful, but a simple person, even an intelligent person, even a simple person, when they hear about something, they want to see what it's doing for you. You hear somebody's philosophy, somebody's idea, we should look and see, well, if I follow like that, then do I become like that person? If what you see the person is what their life success is, based on what they say, you realize maybe what they say isn't so powerful. If we are preaching something, and we're talking about this philosophy will make you happy, and we're not happy, people study us closely, then why should they embrace what we're doing? If we're talking about making better relationships, somebody's preaching about relationships, then you look at that, look at them and you find they've been divorced 7 times. They're talking about taking care of children. You look at them, they're hard toward their kids. They're talking about making big money, getting you to make a plan to make big money. And you look at them and they're impoverished. So a weak-minded person will be enticed by such. You look at most of the people have these kind of strange type of philosophies. And you look at their lives, they're very gloomy looking. They're very angry. Huh? Their philosophy is so much based on the mission that they're on, and their basic mood is a mood of anger, and not a mood of love, not a mood of compassion, not a mood of selflessness. Then you think if you're going to save the world based on that philosophy, something is wrong because you've got to kind of save yourself first. Or if other people take that philosophy, will they become like you? But if there is great devotion, somebody sharing something, is working in their life, has worked in their life is a success story, then immediately we're happy to try to pursue that, take advantage of it. So we look at the example of the servant. It was an example of someone who was very successful, who was successful to the degree that they were taking shelter of acting proper in the Lord Ram's kingdom. It wasn't somebody who had some sort of extraordinary excellence that therefore one should take advantage and listen to what they were saying. But we see how tactfully it was presented in such a way just to be able, ultimately, based on the sovereign interest that the servant herself, in fact, had. So the heartbreak was quite intense that was experienced. Maybe I just read one or two of the passages of this intensity of heartbeat. But first, before I do that, let me just take a detour and I'll come back. I was sent to this morning by, on our GBC conference, is this a nice point, something like Kavi Chandraswami, just describing some of the characteristics of Lord Ram. It's a tangent, but it's like a shirt. It's sort of nice. The sage Narada summarizes the Ramayana to Valmiki. The ascetic Valmiki, who had been practicing austerity and studying the sacred scriptures, inquired from the learned and best of sages Narada, "O sage, at present, who in this world is virtuous? Who possesses prowess? Who knows the principles of religion? Who is grateful for service rendered? Who is truthful? And who has firm resolve? Who possesses good character? Who is the well-wisher of all living beings? Who is truly learned? Who is powerful? Who is most beautiful person?" Yes, it sounds mythological to think of anybody who could have all these qualities. Huh? "Who has self-control? Who has conquered anger? Who is effulgent? Who is non-envious? And of whom do the demigods fear when angered in battle? This is what I wish to hear, for I am filled with extreme curiosity, O great sage. You are capable of knowing such a person." Hearing this request from Valmiki, Narada, it's like, why should we hear from certain people? We should know. No, we hear from Narada. We look at Narada's success story. We look at what he does. Look at his character. We look at his how he's favored by the Lord. Then, yes, there's people we can hear from. Anyone speaking something to us, we want to know. And this is why Acharya Van Purusha Veda, our whole system is based on hearing. Svalitavya, Kiritavya, Smaritavya, it's about hearing and remembering. But it's about hearing from the right source. Hearing from improper sources, one's whole life can become a failure. So many people have made very unhealthy decisions in their life by hearing from improper sources. So many people have lost their fortune, have lost their lives. So many people have committed murder, committed crime, taking drugs. Somebody convinced them, oh, you just have to try it. You won't know what it's like or be able to evaluate it until you try it. And then they take the drug, and then they get hooked on it, and their whole life is downhill after that because of hearing from improper source. Hearing the request from Valmiki Narada, who possesses knowledge of the three worlds. So we hear from someone who has knowledge. So Narada has knowledge in the three worlds. He replied, "Listen." And with great delight, he began to speak. People who are very devotional are very happy to share their devotion. They do not want to keep it to themselves. And they are concerned about the highest well-being of others. Basically, in the material world, people are selfish, and they're often miserable, and they like to see others and enjoy the misery with them. Misery likes comfort. Many times people even set up their best friends in certain ways just because they are experiencing some difficulty in their life, and therefore they extend it consciously or unconsciously. More and more unconsciously, people do it consciously, but often unconsciously. Because if people carry stuff, everybody interacts, they carry and they exchange their stuff on whoever they're dealing with. That cannot be avoided. There's no such thing as ultimate objectivity, except for pure devotees. There's always subjectiveness involved in whatever anybody does. And so therefore, we want to look at the person, what they are, before we consider what we take from them or how it's helping them. We look at the goals that they're about, does it really help them? Like sometimes people go to get help from, you know, mundane to therapists. And we look at what their idea of reality is. We look at what it's doing for them. We look at where it's going to take them. And we realize, oh, and we're saying also earlier today, that if you are really looking for material stability, this is not the right philosophy. Because ultimately, Prabhupada gave us something to take us out of here. Now, if we don't take that serious, it leaves us in a difficult situation. Because then one may be in a situation where it seems like they haven't made it in either world. So it is kind of dangerous to be in this movement and not to take the philosophy serious. Because you miss out from being a strong sense gratifier. And you miss out from having certain material things that you could have if you went only for sense gratification. All the time you're chanting and doing rituals and reading, could be out doing all kinds of sinful things or different things and acquiring more mature empire. Like sometimes the devotee can discourage and say, I worked 15, 20 years, and now what do I have? I did that. Yes, they definitely made a mistake, and they were cheated, if in fact it's that sense gratification was one of the main things they wanted, or material stability. But if they wanted Krishna, whatever happened, if they did serious devotion, that is went for Krishna, and that is part of their permanent account, and nobody can take that, nobody can change that, nobody can alter that, that is theirs. Doesn't matter who fell down, who deviated, who did this or did that. What they were doing was what Krishna's asked them to do, and if they did it properly, Krishna has received. But if they're thinking, now I'm 40, 50 years old, 35 years old, and I don't have things that my mature friends have, I don't have this or that, they're right. Because the process of the movement was not to give them such things as a priority. They may come or they may not come. Sometimes in our devotion, we may get all kinds of material things. We have great devotees who have all types of things, very wealthy, very, very opulent. We have the Rajas, the kings, they had much. King Dasaratha himself, the whole empire. Not small thing, had so much. They're eating off gold plates. They're all kind of opulent. And at the same time, we have some devotees who great devotees who are literate and have nothing. But in each case, they are full of opulence because they have Krishna. In each case, they're experiencing the highest levels of pleasure because they are focused on the goal. And they're accepting what Krishna arranges, what he takes, what he brings. They're just glorifying Krishna. And even sometimes when the demigods intervene, pious demigods, and offer them a boon, they even turn it down. Even though it may be something that they may seem to need or could use, they basically turn it down because if in their mind they're thinking, don't chop me off, they're thinking, what do you mean, offer me something? I want the highest. I want always remember and think of Krishna. It's not that they're just being artificially humble or they're being in denial. They're actually affirming that none of this you can offer is of any higher value than always being able to be in line and service and thinking of Krishna, being favored by Krishna, and therefore they know that all the highest things are for them, and so they want such. Yes, that is mythological, and that is extraordinary, and that is cultish. It is cultish that we're trying to see how to become humble when people in this world are trying to see how to be the greater controller. It is cultish when we're trying to see and look at ourselves to take out whatever nausea is there when people in this material world are trying to see how to acquire greater leverage over others. And we're trying to see how we can serve, and we're being sad when we feel we miss a chance to serve or we miss a chance to act in a devotional way. It is cultish when we're trying to come together to try to see how to remind each other of Krishna through a structured way based on what has been given to us by the acharyas. When people are basically trying to see how to get their own biggest, they're trying to corner this market, they're trying to corner the gold market, the silver market. They're trying to buy their island. They're trying to buy up the country. And people and the demons are doing that. And people in demonic mentality, they want to be as different as possible. And intellectuals, they want to be the moony. They want to see basically how they can make fun or destroy somebody else's theory to establish themselves. And then they have people who are trying to glorify someone else, trying to serve someone else. Yes, that is strange. Because we are about the cult of devotion and love, and they're about the cult of adoration, distinction, and profits, and improving their eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. We're trying to see how we can function as healthy as we can and sleep less. They're eager. Most communists, when they can make it a chance, they want to sleep like anything. We're trying to see how we can control our eating. People consider that it's healthy, that it's wonderful to be able to eat all kinds of things, especially in some cultures. Some cultures, the idea that if you're big, it means, Africa's like that a lot of places, if you are big, it means that you are living a good life. It means that you're eating nicely, you got a lot of things available, a lot of opulence, so it means that you're most likely successful. See, the big ogres, the big chiefs, the big kings, the big market ladies, a lot of money, they're big, and it's a sign of success. But we're finding that in spiritual life, we're trying to see how to depend on less and less external, and how to connect more with internal things. And so that is very strange. And therefore, we have these kind of stories that seem to be full of contradictions. Because they are these divine beings who are coming in trying to set a few things in place for us so that we can catch up with a mentality outside of this mundane eating, sleeping, mating, defending, and identifying with material culture. As a matter of fact, we understand, as we said in the second canto of Bhagavatam, an easy life and devotional service go ill together. We're understanding that one cannot seriously embrace Krishna consciousness if they are too much identifying with day-to-day material life as being the all in all. To the degree that one is identifying, to that degree is the degree that one is lacking the ability really to be transcendental. Doesn't mean that we are to be in denial. Doesn't mean that we are to be ostracizing ourselves away from everything. No, we're not into moksha. Our movement by Lord Nityananda, Lord Nityananda is to be available and to go out and to be relevant. And it's a movement of getting the highest thing, trying to live it, and getting the highest thing and putting it in the sky to help people directly and indirectly. This is the essence of Lord Nityananda's movement. Lord Nityananda's entire movement is coming in disguise, spiritual espionage, trying to help people directly and indirectly, qualified or unqualified, to help them out of their insanity. Even takes sannyas to what? From a Mayavadi sannyasi. He takes sannyas so that people will not make offense. He takes from a Mayavadi sannyasi, so if people, as Vaishnava culture was so disrespected, people would respect the Mayavadi connection more. So he takes sannyas, one of the highest levels of renunciation, from a Mayavadi connection, just to be able to help the people. He shaves off his wonderful locks and even leaves his wonderful wife, just to be able to help people. And part of the leader of Lord Ram is that he leaves his wonderful wife just to help people, to show how leadership should be above suspicion, how they should be, one should be full of character and virtue regardless to whatever is going on. That should be dominant. And so amazing, you think of, again, of this story of the amount of pain that these great personalities undergo to be able to help the world. And so this is our duty. This is definitely cultic or definitely strange when it comes to material nature. But we want to be strange in the devotional way. We want to be full of opulence, of knowledge and devotion and compassion. Whether we have material things or not, we want to have that opulence. And if Krishna decides to give us many, many things, then we will embrace that and we will use it. And if he decides to give us just a minimum amount of things, we will embrace that and we will use it. If he decides to take everything away, our health, our fame, our money, our whatever, we'll say, okay. We are happy that Krishna will do that as he removes whatever obstacles are there so that we can come to him. But if we are hearing from the mundane material culture, then we will become disturbed. And we will also begin to think more about how to conquer over others. We think about more about how to chew the jute. We'll be thinking that what? As Prabhupada once explained, one of the most dangerous things for a renunciate is to have regret. One of the dangerous things for even anyone who enters the Krishna consciousness is to have regret in thinking or identifying with sense gratifiers and then wanting the material things without the knowledge and consciousness and without the being accountable. Start thinking, oh, so I could have this and that and turn against Krishna and I get this. So such mentality then can draw one to such. Therefore, we are always to have, and we're telling with the children, we are to see that they understand what they're doing. That's one of the questions at the school today. They're reading songs and they're chanting some mantras. And so I ask, so can they explain something about what they just chanted? What the songs they're singing and the mantras. Otherwise, the mentality of the adults or the children, if we do things and just do them as rituals, then at some point we will not want to do them, or we won't get the full benefit, because the more that one is in knowledge and doing something, then the greater the benefit in fact is. And then the less one gets interfered, or the less one gets tricked by improper hearing. The more that one understands something, and somebody brings in some idea, somebody says, oh, you're worshiping spiritual masters. Sometimes they call awareness, they do people like that. It's, oh, you're worshiping these people, you're bowing down, you're doing this, you're doing that. And then one who's in material conscious can think, yeah, why am I giving over my individuality to anyone? Why am I living a life and a philosophy about trying to be humble? This is a lack of self-esteem. But we understand the power in truthfulness and humility. And we are humble in the sense that we are honoring power. We're honoring Krishna, and we're honoring divinity. And because of that, we humble ourselves to it, because we want to connect with it. But in Orthodox considerations, the way devotees think is like lack of self-esteem. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't sometimes involve ourselves in lack of self-esteem. That does happen also. We have to separate that. But it's not based on our philosophy. It's based on some sociological patterns that are dysfunctional within the society, institution, within ourselves. But when someone has great strength, they always have a sense of humility as a part of that, because they do not have to boast, or they do not have to feel intimidated, because they realize what they're connected with or what they can do. So we don't have to be like the fundamentalists, where we are trying to force people to think exactly as we think or act exactly as we act. Many people, religious organizations and material culture, they want to force people. From anything normal in society, locked up in such a way. Yeah, this, for any person who's thinking about data and normal mature information, this sounds weird. You're following the personality you call the Lord, and the last years on the planet, he locked himself up like a madman. Mad in love with Krishna, mad in love for the world. So we realize that everybody is mad. The materialists are mad for karma, and we are trying to be mad for prema. They're mad of how to engage in more and more of the temporary things that bring devastation and defeat ultimately, and more visits to Yamaraj. And we are mad about telling Yamaraj never again, that now we want to do whatever is necessary to be able not only to read and to visit the holy pilgrimage places, but we're ready now that we want to eternally live in such places. And so we're reading about such, and we're visiting such, and we hear about such, and we remind each other about such, because we're trying to get ourselves packed, our bags, so to speak, so that we can go to such places. And so people who are thinking that there's no place to go other than where they already are, of course they will have trouble when they see those in movement trying to attain what the ultimate position of being in the human body is all about. But we are not to be selfish in the process. We are to try to keep moving and to try to encourage others in this cult of devotion, the cult of love, or the culture of love and devotion. So these wonderful pastimes of Lord Ram about adventure, love, and wisdom, wonderful, seemingly human, almost activity, is even more an extension of Krishna's mercy, of how he comes in these various forms to interact more in this Marchaloka, these hellish places, where it is very hard for people to think differently. But knowing that some people will, then these things, pastimes go on. And while they go on, secondarily, he kills these demons, annihilates the demons, engages in the Yuga Dharma. But the real essence of it is the sharing of the love that is eternally there for the living entity, that he gives the living entity a taste when he comes into the material world. And his servants give us a little taste about what's possible. So we want to try to live our life in such a way that it does bewilder people less, because more people could literally join our ranks if, in fact, they were clear about what we are, what we do, and if, in fact, they saw more results based on what we do and how it's making our lives, our communities better, and then more people themselves, especially people who are pious, then they would also say, yeah, Otherwise, we have pious people who become our enemies because they become confused at some of the things that they are not able to understand, or things that they understand that they realize is not the lifestyle or activities of people who are aligned with a higher understanding. It doesn't show that they are following according to that understanding. So much of what may disturb people about our movement is stuff that disturbs us also. It's stuff that has very little to do with what Prabhupada has given us. It's part of the acculturation. As we embrace what Prabhupada has given us, then we will be different. There'll be a difference, but with a sense of purity. Difference with a sense of nobility. Difference with a sense of strong focus about what our Siddhanta is. And then many people will see a difference even in an exotic way and will want to be like us, but may feel they can't be like us, but they will at least be able to honor the priest for what we do and want to support it. And in this way, they will advance. Not that everybody has a Sukriti, a Gana Sukriti, to be able to take to Krishna consciousness and say yes. Because we see that the karma factor is there and the use of free will. But so many people can serve Krishna consciousness in a certain way. Some people can work for Krishna. They can help those who are doing, etc. And people will do more and more of that as they see what we do is actually bringing a real sense of value. And there's certain things that just pious people will identify as value. They may not understand transcendence, but they will identify certain basic things that are connected to the mode of goodness as valuable. And it's on the mode of goodness that's the launching pad for transcendence. I'm explaining in Mayapur this year that a serious issue in our movement, I've mentioned it once or twice here, is that we speak about transcendence all the time. And we write about it, and we talk about it. But at the same time, so many of our activities are in the mode of ignorance and passion. We speak about Sanatana Dharma, why not honoring Dharma? And so this is one reason why my mind is also so important, because it emphasizes virtue and Dharma. For not that we get stuck in Dharma, or we get stuck in the mode of goodness. But Bhagavad Gita, in the 10:14, explains, Prabhupada explains in the purport, how Vaishnavas usually work out of the mode of goodness. It means what? Mode of goodness is truthfulness. Mode of goodness is cleanliness. Mode of goodness is compassion. Mode of ignorance and mode of passion is a lot of the stuff that we find floating around. Lack of communication, deviation, duplicity, lack of integrity, corruption, these things, abuse, spouse abuse, child abuse, these things, all things, mode of ignorance and mode of passion. It's practically a joke trying to become transcendental from the mode of being captured in the mode of ignorance and passion. So we have so many embarrassments because people being in the mode of ignorance and passion and then talking transcendence, and so therefore they can only hold on with such for so long because Maya sees through that. And Maya sees easy avenues for attacking when that goes on like that. But as we are connecting with the mode of goodness, and then it becomes the organic arrangement to embrace transcendence. But some people are so much captured by moksha consciousness, so much captured by power over devotion, that when they hear mode of goodness thing, they think it is touchy-feely. They become so much distracted by materialism, so much distracted by individualism, so much distracted by material sovereignty, so much distracted by information rather than wisdom and knowledge, that when they hear mode of goodness, they think it is something that is simply cult stuff or it's just touchy-feely. Without understanding that Vaishnavas are well-wishers of all, and therefore their life penetrates and helps people either become devotional or it helps them in rising from the modes of ignorance. Jiva Goswami, preaching to the ruffians as well as to the devotional class was a sign of their caring for everybody and being able to affect everybody. It's not that they try to get everybody on the spot to become a full-fledged devotee. Is that they help people and their own life was a sign of the devotion. Prabhupada talked to George Harrison's gardener, never even preached to him, but he had a permanent effect on him because of what he was, what he carried, what he brought into the connection. And so when we are carrying more and more devotion, we don't have to even say so much. It's what we bring, what we are. And we will naturally bring out the devotion. When others have devotion, when others have deviation, we will bring that out. If there is devotion, it will connect where there is devotion. And so because there was so much love amongst Lord Rama and his associates, then the love just intensified and intensified. And they're ready to go with Lord Rama at any cost, to leave the highest level of royalty and then to go in the greatest level of renunciation. But the love was such that they couldn't think of not going, letting him go and not going. Or his love for his father, so that he could not think of allowing his father to make some promise and not to be able to be known as one who honored his promise. This is all mode of goodness stuff, virtual, except such things. Because Lord is coming to show on this planet how to be a proper husband, how to be a proper leader. Not that he just says, after all, you know, we don't have to follow these rules. They don't apply to us. Because we have come from the spiritual world. I am God. That doesn't apply to me. The opposite. Not that we think that we can be unethical and immoral because we are transcendentalists. You know, that's a joke. Sometimes some things that devotees may do that even some ethical people would have difficulty with. Sometimes some things even our leaders do, that even our mothers and fathers, who basically are just ethical, if they knew about it, they would say, what? How do you do this in your society? And they're not even transcendental. Therefore, we have to begin to redefine, when we read these stories and have these wonderful opportunities, what is really going on? That virtue and character is most important. And that one must be humble, and humility means speaking truth. It doesn't mean being naive, it doesn't mean being blind follower, it means being able to honor truth, whatever the consequences are, realizing that Krishna is there. And taking that in the spirit of being able to offer whatever we're saying or doing, it must be offerable to Krishna. If it's not offerable, then we have to look closer at ourselves or closer to see what we can do so that we can work on ourselves or work on the environment so that it can, in fact, be offered. And when we are being able to offer things to Krishna, then the Ravana aspects will not keep coming in on us, on the environment, etc. But when we are not properly having proper spiritual strength and our immune system is weak, then Krishna allows it to be obvious, to be noticeable. When one's spiritual immune system is weak, then we get all of this maya coming in. Like when the body is weak, then you're more susceptible to all kinds of germs and diseases. And it's sending you a signal. Then things about the body, you get fever, you get diarrhea, you get vomiting, letting you know that there's some things that have been intruded into the body that's unhealthy. And the body's working on itself, trying to get out of it, get rid of it. So when we find some things happening that's like disease, we have to look and see what is coming to the body. It has to be dealt with. Our individual bodies, our families, our institutions, etc. So in Bhakti Vinod's time, that the Vaishnava body had become so contaminated. So Vishwanath Chakravarti, he was praying, and then Baladeva Jibusan came in to join him. Because what people were seeing as Vaishnava, the highest philosophy, people were seeing it as simply the basic lifestyle of the Sahaja. So even ordinary people were ethical. They were having trouble with what was going on. So if something powerful is not used properly, then even ordinary people will have disturbance with it. What does it say of taking to it? So in conclusion, we think about these great stories, and we think about it about in three major ways. We think about how Krishna is always on the case, coming in himself in so many wonderful ways. We think about how he comes in with his loving coalition from time to time, coming in such a way to be able to benedict the world. We think about how, yes, in spite of whatever difficulties there are, that Krishna will be victorious, and those who associate with him will be victorious. And we expect there will be the attacks. We expect that there will be the big Ravanas and the little Ravanas. We expect that there will be the challenges. We expect that there will be those who sometimes are loyal, sometimes not, sometimes who turn against the basic system. That is always there. But we are to go on lovingly trying to see how to give and how to serve. We're to go on with a sense of humility, a sense of submissiveness, but boldness. Balaram was bold. He was great. He was hearing what everyone was saying, but he was sick. But he had to represent. He had to represent that which would show what is proper dharma. Even to the point that we see at the end of removing himself from Sita, removing Sita from him. So this is extreme, and this is unordinary, extraordinary. So we are being given a chance to embrace this extraordinary philosophy that is about the spiritual world. And we don't want to be just normal people, but we want to do the things that are considered normal in terms of maintaining body nicely so we don't have to worry about the body. We want to have money, we don't have to worry about money. We want to have good health or have the best that we can, we don't have to worry about this. There's less of a distraction. And we want to constantly see that the secondary things are enhancing or coinciding, complementing the primary. And in this way, then, we are not just reading about such things, but we begin to connect deeper and deeper with these pastimes. We begin to unfold in our consciousness. It's not that we are the people who are supposed to wait until we leave this body, and then we begin to accept and think about these things as being real. We are the movement that we're supposed to be gradually coming to the point where we becoming like that, and then we leave the body, we go and do what eternally what we're already beginning to basically become. And so that's very difficult. If too much more the ignorance and more the passion activities are there, or we're too much trying to connect with the data and the normal patterns of mature energy. So I think I only have 5 minutes or so. Let's see if there's any questions. I really didn't mean to talk quite that long. Yes.
About hearing from the right source. Sometimes when we are revealing our mind amongst devotees, because we're not pure, we may intend to give like good advice or whatever, but a contamination may come through. And Prabhupada using the analogy that we should become expert to be able to take gold from even a filthy place. So how do we distinguish that we are still receiving gold and it hasn't become contaminated?
It's not a problem. If someone is following principles, they have good intention, they're trying to help you, you're trying to help them. Even if the material advice is not the most expert, Krishna will come through. See, as long as we do what Krishna wants us to do, he's given us the basic thing. When we take the devotional service, one of our major identities is we pledge before the fire, we pledge before the assembly of devotees, we pledge before the deities, etc. And we're pledging to four very serious things, which are, when we not honor them, they're pillars to the sin, maintaining sinful culture. See, it's not so much in Kali Yuga that we do anything so expertly. Whether it's chanting mantras, whether it's chanting our rounds, whether it's service, not anything so expertly. Everything we do is full of faults and offenses. But the point is, you have to adhikar, what is our ability, how we're using what we have, and what is our intent. And Krishna knows all of that. Many times people just care. I mean, Sankirtan devotees have good experience of this sometimes. Sometimes the devotee, and there's stories like this that some devotees have had, where they go to someone trying to sell a book, and they get tongue-tied, or they're crying, or this, that, and the person buys the book. It's because the devotee affects them by the heart. Or many of us, when we join the movement, it may have been somebody who didn't really preach so nicely, but they were someone who influenced our hearts. Because they approached us with a sense of really trying to share or trying to give, and they just did, you know, their best. And Krishna arranged, because he's in each person's heart. So he arranged that there was some connection that takes place. If we just remind ourselves that it's really Krishna who is doing everything. Now the question is whether it's Krishna is doing it based on his Bahiranga Shakti, Tathasa, Antaranga. Is Krishna doing it? So the more that we have faith in Krishna, do as he wants, then he will do it anyway. He will arrange what is best for each person. He will take away, and he's promised like that. And he will give what we need, maintain what we have, and what we lack, and he will complement. He promised that. And if he is not really able to deliver, we have no reason worshiping Krishna at all. But based on the fact that everything is under him, then we can recognize that if we do, then he will do. So many issues really come down to actually lack of faith. But again, that's not an easy thing, you know, to acquire. Because it comes from association, it comes from what we've been from the past, it comes from what's happening to us in the present, it comes from the quality of association that we have at any given time, so many different things. But so many problems are due to lack of faith, because the science works. And when our faith is weak, it's like if the medicine is good, doctor's proper, then you take it proper, you get the proper results. But the doctor's okay, the medicine's okay, but you're not so sure, so you kind of take a little bit sometimes, sometimes not, or you're not so careful about being regulated because you're not really that much accepting that it's going to help you. And so there's a difference. So a lot of things are there because of a lack of faith, and because of that, then we do not follow the science properly in such a way. And in England, I was doing a facilitation with the leaders there. They wanted me to do like a half a day workshop with the leaders. And one or two was mentioning, well, we've done so much austerity, now isn't it time that we go to the other extreme, isn't it okay? First of all, he was joking. Then he was serious. He was saying, so we basically, let me explain. He was saying, we basically tried to be austere in serving Prabhupada. And so many difficulties came from that. So that was an extreme. Sometimes we were just thinking of the mission and we weren't being practical. So now if we just think basically about our material concerns, if we go to that extreme, isn't that okay? Then doesn't it one extreme, another extreme, then gradually bring a medium? So he was justifying, if we don't come to program, if we don't chant around, if we have this effect, we do some of these things, and that may be extreme, but one extreme, another extreme, then it'll make a balance. In these two extremes, it'll make a balance. And I thought he was joking. They are serious. And then I explained, in my mood of being disturbed, I said, the problem is not so much one extreme, it's that we haven't done the thing properly. And therefore, let's see how to do the right thing in the right way and not reject the right thing and do something deviant and think that it's going to bring a sense of a medium. As if two wrongs would then, and there's a certain logic like that. Two wrongs, this extreme, that extreme, so now it kind of comes to the center. But people can find many ways to rationalize not honoring the right thing or lack of faith, and so therefore the tendency is, you know, let's do something different. Other questions? Well, Krishna knows intention. And we see many stories like that, like the Brahmana from southern India, who was very poor. But he heard that you can serve the Lord in the mind. So he didn't have much, but because he wanted to serve, Krishna arranged for him to do it. Or the Brahmana who was asked to read so many chapters of Bhagavad Gita. He was not endowed with so much, but it's a matter of consciousness. And therefore it was accepted, even though it was done improperly. But it was accepted. Sure, I call it Vecha. I mean, he wasn't a powerful businessman or such an intellect or had opulence or whatever. But what he had, he genuinely was making that available and genuinely appreciating that Krishna has arranged my life like this and let me simply glorify him. And because of that, then we see Krishna even not only blesses him but comes to him in such a way. But it's not easy to have strong faith when our past sometimes has been a little shaky, the present is a little uncertain. So much of the faith is based on what you're anticipating for the future. And that's why we have to be even more careful of what we're seeing, what we're hearing, and what we're doing. And when we're in doubt, we should run to Prabhupada's books. We should run to his lectures. To hear, what did he say? What did he do in those kind of situations? What did the other acharyas, what did they do? And then we begin to base so much of our thinking around such. Otherwise, the mind is full of tricks. And it's been tricking us for so many lifetimes. It's been doing a pretty good job. So we don't want to be so eager to embrace our intelligence when the intelligence is so much covered over with so much conditioning from the mind and the senses. Now that may sound strange, because we're not being some blind followers, but we have to want to go beyond our intelligence. Not that we want to just not to think. We have to be the big thinkers that we're constantly scrutinizing to see how much is based on Sadhu, Shastra, and Guru. And then we dive into it, essentially. And Krishna is there. As long as we do what he wants. I mean, what is really going on in all of the universe? There's nothing but Krishna and his part and parcels. And so because we are so much in a state of illusion, that he arranges to appear through Shastra, he arranges to manifest through sadhus, he arranges to manifest through guru. But what is really a guru? It is really an agent to remind us about the door for reaching Krishna. An agent for helping us to practice for what we ultimately do eternally with Krishna. It's all about the Lord. So the more that we can have greater faith in Krishna, then so many things that are extremely difficult and some things almost impossible to overcome can be moved through. There are things that we can never move through them fully, just based on our senses, our mind, and our intelligence. Because, you know, Maya is stronger than any civilization, what to say, of any person, working perfectly for Krishna. But if we let connect with Maya's boss, and we've all seen that. We've seen many times in our lives. We tried many things, and it just didn't happen. And then somehow something we try and it happens, because when Krishna is pleased, when it's transcendentally connected, then it happens, and it happens even better than if we would have planned it step by step. We all keep having those experiences, but somehow we forget it from time to time. We forget what it's like when we really try to surrender and we see how we feel internally and what happens. We forget what it's like when we're so much on ulterior motive or our plan and doesn't work and gets more and more frustration. But like in the case of Draupadi, you know, and she threw her hands up and Krishna was there. And when she was holding on to the sari, there was a problem. She threw up and I mean, Krishna was fully there with her sister. But throwing your hands up is not easy. Because we are bound so much by day-to-day and activities where when you really reveal yourself, or when you really try to be genuine, people cheat you and they abuse you or they turn against you. And so there's always a fear. But we have to have more fixation in Krishna and be able to enjoy. Enjoy when people turn against you, when they say something to show your fault. Use it. Enjoy when people criticize you. Try to see how to serve better. Enjoy when Krishna takes away. Try to see how to use better what we do have. Enjoy a chance to try to see how Krishna is going to resolve this one, resolve that one. That is the adventure and the love and the wisdom. It's all a part of so many other leelas that's there. What an exciting God that we're connected with. How boring the God when you go, not trying to demise any other theology, but how boring it is that for us, we go to this beautiful, beautiful building, it's a mosque, and there's no deity. We go to a beautiful cathedral, beautiful, ornate, so wonderful, and there's no deity. We feel some quite empty in such a way. But how wonderful, even with just a little structure, we walk in and there's a beautiful deity. Because we're excited about the God who is just there, playing on a flute, who is there, and his life is about wonderful, amorous activities. We're there, the God who loves his creation so much that he will come as Vamadeva, that he'll come as Nrisimhadeva, that he'll come as a ruler, mundane ruler in one sense, of material kingdom. We're amazed that God loves us so much that even though we keep turning away from him lifetime after lifetime, that he never turns away from us. And he keeps finding these miraculous ways that people say is mythology, these miraculous ways to come to extend his love. And so we honor this appearance of Lord Ram. It's one of those expressions when the Lord has come and brought his special agents to bring in more of this love that we have somehow turned our backs toward. It's confounded, Charles, the divine grace, A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami, Prabhupada Ki. Isi Varha Dhammada Varakas and Jagannabaladev Subhadriki Sivam Naomi Ki.